Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, I'm speaking with Amanda Householder. Now, Amanda is another person from a documentary that I watched and had one person on from, oh goodness, I think 3 or 4 months ago. I had Ruthie Hyler on from the Let Us Pray documentary. You know, if you've listened to this podcast long enough, you know that I like to speak to people from, you know, different documentaries and I guess more specifically, a lot of documentaries about cults, people who have been in cults. Some have had, you know, I guess, good experiences, if you can say that. Some have had very bad experiences. I would say most of them have had bad experiences. If you remember with Ruthie Hyler, she was in IFB, which is the Independent Fundamentalist Baptist Church. It's a movement. It's a branch off of the Baptist Church world that, you know, many people would call a cult. Amanda is one of those people that would. Ruthie is one of those people. If you watch the documentary, I'll let you kind of decide for yourself that. But Ruthie kind of covered exactly what IFB is, exactly what the churches look like, some of the kind of the mind control that's there, some of the terrible things that happen within those churches. Ruthie herself had several instances of sexual abuse in the church, and through the documentary was going through the process of getting her abuser tried and, you know, eventually convicted of his crimes. We talk a little bit about that with Ruthie. Again, that was a couple months ago. But the thing that I kind of left out of the whole IFB world when I talked to Ruthie, because I knew I was eventually going to talk to Amanda, and that is that IFB had some troubled teen homes. There's a whole troubled teen industry. I'd like to go deeper into that at some point. You know, there's several people out there doing podcasts that talk about it, but this is specifically about the troubled teen industry within IFB. Amanda was at two different troubled teen homes, but we're going to talk about a troubled teen home specifically for girls in Missouri called Circle of Hope, and then we're going to talk about Agape, which I believe was in Florida. You know, Amanda is a great person to speak with about this for two reasons. One, she grew up in this world. She was raised within Circle of Hope. Second reason is, you know, the people who ran this home were her parents. So we're going to talk to her about, you know, the terrible things that happen within Circle of Hope. That's kind of where we focus, because I think that it kind of branched off from Agape, and that's where her parents kind of took charge. So we're going to talk a lot about Circle of Hope. We'll talk about what it was like to, you know, to have these things happening, these atrocities happening, and it be your parents, and how having this happen was just kind of almost allowing the outside world to see exactly what her parents were already doing to her. So, you know, this is a really powerful conversation. You know, I really, really appreciate Amanda agreeing to join me to speak about it. You know, it can't be an easy topic. You know, her parents now have been arrested and not yet convicted of any crimes. You know, of course, everyone's innocent until proven guilty. But their trial continues to get pushed back. We're going to talk a little bit about their trial and what's to be expected from that. We're going to talk a lot about just growing up in Circle of Hope, the rules, the punishments, the restraints that was being done, how, you know, the older girls were expected to help restrain other girls as punishment, and kind of what that did psychologically when they were kind of pitting, you know, girls against each other. We're going to talk about why parents sent their kids to these places, definitely when, you know, some of the things were already kind of a little bit known. So yeah, this is a really powerful conversation about IFB, but more importantly about the troubled teen industry and Circle of Hope. Think you're going to really, really enjoy this one. Really, really appreciate Amanda, you know, joining me to share her story. Towards the end, a few times, I think that maybe her dog was wanting to join the conversation as well. It was just for a minute or two towards the end, but do know that, you know, I wasn't able to edit that out, but, you know, during that time, she was saying something really, really important. So I really, really appreciate you being here. I appreciate Amanda being here. Here is Amanda Householder. I'm here today with Amanda Householder. Miss Householder, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Let's just kind of jump right into the topic today. I did speak with someone else within IFB in the past, somebody else who was also in the documentary. I think it was like 4 months ago now, but I spoke with Ruthie Heiler. So we know just a little bit about, you know, the group. But I always like to kind of just ask individuals their own, I guess their own definition of exactly what was IFB, and then maybe more importantly, how did yourself and your family get involved?
IFB stands for Independent Fundamental Baptist. My mom and dad were, I don't know how to explain it exactly, but my mom was raised Catholic and my dad was raised Independent Fundamental Baptist. At the age of 17, my dad tried running away. My mom ran away basically from Catholicism. But then when they got together, somehow they ended up back at my dad's parents' church. And so I was born into the IFB. But yeah, I was born into it. There's not really much other than that. I wasn't around, I guess, for when my parents got back into it to talk much about that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So what, and this is a huge, tall task, and, you know, you guys spent basically, what, 4+ episodes on the documentary that you were featured on explaining IFB, but if someone just needs a, you know, a 30-second snapshot, what is IFB? What is the Independent Fundamentalist Baptist Movement?
Oh, okay, so there's a lot of different, like, sections of the IFB, I guess, if that's what you, so there's the Jack Hyles, Lester Roloff, there's a couple of different ones. I'm not too familiar of all of them, but like Bob Jones, yeah. University and more like that. My parents specifically were Lester Roloff. My dad was friends with David Hyles and really was against Hyles Anderson, as weird as it may sound, because my dad turned out to be a lot like those people he despised. Lester Roloff, he started the Rebecca Homes for Girls. It's basically what is known as the troubled teen industry. So the portion of the IFB that I was in was mainly with, they worked with a lot of troubled teens. I was part of a church towards the end of my IFB time, but Agape and Agape mainly had their own church, which a lot of the teachings, they're the same teachings that are in the normal churches, but when it's like a cult community that you literally can't leave, it's a little bit different. So for like Agape, a lot of the teachings were children must obey their parents, all centered around like teens and behavioral issues. Like one of the things that they like to talk about was how like back in the olden days they could go out, bury or dig a hole, bury us in it, throw rocks at us. So a lot of what we were taught within these homes were torture tactics that the Bible basically gave to these quote unquote teachers to discipline children, when in fact it wasn't discipline, it was straight up abuse.
Yeah, and I want to dive a lot deeper into that. But, you know, when I watched this documentary, when I talked to Ruthie, the thing that surprised me, and you already mentioned, you know, Jack Hyles, is
I had no idea this was all so close to home to me. It seems like all of these cults that I watch these documentaries are in my backyard. I live in Indiana. Jack Hiles is from Northern Indiana. You know, I watched that just off topic, but I watched, you know, the whole Duggar Family Secrets, and they had a huge training center here in Indianapolis. I feel like all these cults are in Indiana. I don't know what's up with Indiana, if they're just naive, or why everyone is around here.
I don't know much about Indiana, but I can assume it's a lot like Missouri. Like in Missouri, there's a lot of exemptions for like these schools to like we couldn't get the state to step in to do anything because of separation of church and state. And I'm sure Indiana is pretty much the same way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right for sure. So yeah, you know, when I spoke to Ruthie, it was a lot about, you know, IFB, her own experience, but I purposely didn't ask her any questions about, you know, the troubled teen industry and girls ranches and those things, because I knew that was something you knew a lot more about. So you've already kind of touched on it, but I want you just more to explain exactly what these girls ranches are. And then, you know, maybe more importantly, you talked about how, you know, the troubled teen industry and how did people get sent there? Because, you know, the other churches that have these quote unquote troubled teen groups, a lot of times people are being sent for goofy things, like, you know, took one puff of a cigarette and now they're damned to hell or something like that. So what is it? And then why were people being sent?
So the troubled teen industry is a group of what it's therapeutic boarding schools, wilderness programs, religious boarding schools. It's not just religious boarding schools, but what I know is the religious portion of it. My parents worked at three different ones, one in Florida, one in Stockton, Missouri, and then one in Humansville. They're not all just for troubled girls. The first one my parents worked at in Missouri was also for boys. When I went to the one in Stockton, when my parents worked there, I was just a staff child, meaning that I went to like the staff school. I wasn't working there. I was 10. I was told that these kids were there for because they were in gangs. They were court ordered there for killing and all that stuff. What I've known now as an adult, most of these kids had RAD. Like a lot of them were adopted, so they had attachment issues. They had a lot of mental health issues that they really truly needed help with, but that's not what they got at these schools. I know at Circle of Hope, my parents got a 5-year-old, and there's nothing, in my opinion, there's nothing a 5-year-old could do to be sent away to a place for troubled teens. But these schools prey on parents who need help with their kids. Now, not all the students that are getting sent away need mental health help. Some of the parents were really heavily into IFB. And like you said, some of these kids were getting sent away for stupid things like taking a puff of a cigarette. Trying to remember, there was one girl who she went to church in Eldon, Missouri, and she got sent away to Circle of Hope. I can't remember exactly why, but it was something really stupid. Like she didn't go to bed on time, or she was watching a movie that wasn't appropriate for the religion. But sometimes they got sent away for, in my opinion, no reason at all. Like they're normal teens. But unfortunately, some of these kids really, truly needed help. And that is far from what they got there. So
were these parents, you said that they were kind of preyed upon too. So my question there is, you know, was IFB in the teachings of that telling people that they should be sending their kids away if they did something wrong, or what's making these parents, I guess, send their kids here? You know, obviously we talked about how, you know, some of them have mental health issues. Some of them have very minor issues. Why were parents, I guess, sending kids there? Was it part of the teaching or something else?
Not every parent that sent their kids there were IFB. So now the IFB parents, they were sending their kids there for like literally anything. And I won't say that they were preyed upon. They definitely were not preyed upon. Now, parents that have nothing to do with the independent fundamental Baptist religion, I feel like those parents were preyed upon. I know two parents from Circle of Hope specifically that sent their daughter to Circle of Hope to get the daughter away from an abusive situation at home between the parent, like domestic violence between the parents. And the selling point for them was it was a Christian home. And when you think Christianity, you think Jesus, you think Jesus died for all of our sins. Like, you're not going to think abuse and all of the horrible things that actually happened there. And so those parents are the ones I'm specifically speaking on that were preyed upon, because the moment their daughters, either their daughter reached out by sending a code, like one of them, she was in foster care at one point with an extremely abusive foster parent. And so all she did was write home, "Oh, this place is amazing, just like so-and-so, the foster parents." And her mom was like, "Wait, that place was bad." And her mom instantly showed up within, like, I think it took her two nights to get there, and she was from North Carolina. So that was pretty fast, in my opinion, dropping everything she could. And then another mom, she's actually, if you Google Circle of Hope, she's like the first parent to bring attention to what was going on there and was not listened to by the state, by the police, by anyone. She was very, she didn't come and visit the place, which was really stupid. She admits that now, but she needed to get her daughter into somewhere safe because of the situation at home. And the first day she went and visited, she started taking pictures and realizing this place is not good at all. And she, I think it was like her daughter stayed there 3 months, and then she came and got her when she really was like, okay, no, something, like her daughter broke her toe or something like that. And she's like, no. And so she came and got her daughter. And so there are some parents that I wouldn't say were preyed upon, but there are certain parents that really tried getting their child help and were sold on the fact that it was a Christian place. And you don't think abuse when you think of Jesus or Christianity or things like that.
So why were these girls' ranches, why were they doing these preying upon? Was it because kind of a head count, and the more people they were able to get, you know, state funding? Was it like a conversion thing, or why did they want all of these additional kids there?
So I can't speak for every single owner. I can't even speak for my parents specifically. I can speak on why I feel like my parents did.
Sure.
Now Agape, they housed 200 plus boys, and they didn't get state funding. If they got state funding, then that meant the state could come in and do a lot of different things. And that's exactly what they didn't want. So they got donations from church, which was a lot of money. Now, Agape was another Hiles Anderson. So they had a lot of the preachers from Hiles Anderson come out and preach. I can't say Hiles Anderson donated, but I'm almost positive they donated. But so not only were they getting donations from the church, they were getting donations from the parents, or not donations, they were getting paid from the parents as well. Agape was bringing in millions of dollars a year. So in my personal opinion, it was a money thing. Also, personally knowing some of these staff, they are sadistic and psychotic, and they got off on torturing kids. It's really gross growing up thinking this is normal, this is like whatever, and then becoming an adult and realizing like, no, these adults were really, really mentally ill themselves. And took it out on kids and got paid to do it. Now, for my dad, like I said, they worked at a home in Florida. The first home in Florida, I was a baby, so I can't tell you everything that happened there. But I do know we originally left in the early 90s because my parents wanted to start a co-ed home. That didn't happen. So they went back to that home and then eventually moved to Stockton, Missouri with Agape. I thought that was going to be our forever place. It wasn't. Agape started getting a little more liberal in the sense that the staff daughters could wear shorter skirts. Not me, because my dad had different, it was different in everyone's household. But when that started happening, my dad and mom were like, we're opening a new place. Well, originally it was going to be co-ed. Like I said, in Florida, it was going to be co-ed. Well, then at Agape, they were thinking like, oh, well, we can't compete with a 200 plus boys home. And so that's why they said that they wanted to open a girls home. But again, being an adult now, one, my parents did it for power. My parents did it for money. But I personally feel like they specifically opened a girls home due to the fact that my dad would have be able to have his way with the students there, because knowing now what I know, not just at Circle of Hope, but at the home in Florida, the things my dad did, my dad was a predator. And I do feel like he personally opened it because he was a predator.
And I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, the experience that those who came to these homes, I guess, in particular Circle of Hope, the experience that they had. You know, in the documentary, you talked about how, you know, people were beaten for not standing still. They were made to recite church verses over and over, kind of trying to program them not to want to talk to their family. I want to kind of talk a little bit about that experience, because you talked about how, you know, people were being sent here because of mental health issues, or because, you know, they had some other reason, trying to get away from abuse in the home. And then it was just probably amplified when they got here. So I want to kind of talk about that experience for the average person at Circle of Hope.
So the first thing that happens when a girl got sent to Circle of Hope was they got taken off their medication, all of it. If they were on SSRIs, antidepressants, any birth control, acne medicine, all of their medicine, they were taken off of. My parents, really weird, because growing up, I believed they didn't believe in medicine, but being an adult now, they did, because my dad was on insulin, my mom was on blood thinners. They took medicine themselves, but they would say that they didn't believe in medicine because mental health issues were the devil. It's not something wrong with your brain. It's the devil, in their opinion. So that the first thing, they would get taken off of all of that. Well, that's definitely not good. And a lot of times that did cause outburst with the girls. A lot of the times when girls were sent there, a lot of the times it was because of abuse that was going on at home. One of my friends that I actually ran away with was sent there because her stepfather was raping her, and her mom found out and was jealous and so sent her away. For her specifically, we ran away 2 months after the opening because my dad was being inappropriate with her, touching her and things like that. And so we ran away. She never came back, but myself and the other girl that ran away did come back. For me, I was put on the wall. What happened to me when I came back was bad, but it wasn't, it was normal for me because I was raised in this. But the girl that came back, she never got out of a orange shirt after that. Like, she was constantly either an orange or a black shirt. There was a lot of, it's really hard to explain the everyday happenings that went on there, because my dad was so wishy-washy on certain things. Like, one day we would be able to like go out and play like softball, and the next day we wouldn't be able to do that. So there were some times that we got a little bit of freedom, but then that would have been ripped away like super, super fast. A lot of the girls, I'm trying to think of any instances where like them getting off the meds like really messed up, like gave outbursts, but I can't think of that because my dad was extremely scary. A lot of us learned very, very early on to just, you don't show emotion. But a lot of the punishments were extreme workouts. His favorite was a restraint, and Bible verses. Honestly, I don't have an issue with learning or reciting Bible verses, like whatever. That's not an issue. The workouts weren't bad either. It was the extremeness of the workouts. They had I think it was 2 acres of land, not including the forest they had, but I'm pretty sure it was 2 acres of land that they had. And the girls would have to do laps around that until they could not, well, even if they couldn't continue the laps, they would still have to get up and do the laps. I remember a lot of the times, and I mentioned this in the documentary, a lot of the times when they were done either the huge workouts or the excessive outdoor yard work, you couldn't move. Like your arms were like rubber. Like it was over the top brutalness. And one of the things my dad loved to say was like, he was a drill instructor and they would do this in the Marines. The thing is, these are kids. And a lot of the times those are either 17-year-old plus, and they don't even do it for all day. Like it's not, there was a difference. Like it was from sun up to sun down that the extreme workouts or the extreme child labor was happening there. Like I had mentioned, restraints was one of my dad's favorite forms of punishment. And it's really hard to give you an instance on, I have one. There was a girl, Rachel Kelso. She was a year older than me and was sent in 2000 and I want to say 2007. She was sent there at 17 and did not leave until 2020. And she was like 30, I think. She was, I don't know her medical diagnosis, but she was mentally ill. Like she acted like an 8-year-old. I know that's not like the correct way of saying a diagnosis, but that's how she was around us. She was the sweetest person ever. But on top of that, she couldn't control her emotions. If she felt sad, she would show she was sad. If she got excited, she would show her excitement. And she would get punished for either of those. She would get punished for crying or she would get punished for being overexcited. And by what I mean by punished was my dad would pick her up by the neck, throw her on the ground and call restraint. And restraints were where we would, I say we, but we were teenagers being forced to put all of our weight on pressure points. And so it literally, like, you could get in trouble for anything and you could get any of these workouts or any of these, every day was child labor. We were outside doing hard labor, building buildings and things like that. It's hard to explain why we would get in trouble because you could have gotten in trouble for like literally anything.
Yeah. And you just mentioned kind of the whole calling for restraint and you happened to hold people down. So what I was trying to figure out there is, were you kind of involved in some of this, you know, these punishments because, you know, you were family and on staff, or was everyone expected to be involved? You know, the other girls were kind of punishing each other.
So everyone, as in like the older girls. So if you were, I would say 15 and up, it could have changed when I left because a lot of things did change after I left. But if you were 15 and you had a green shirt, a red shirt, or a purple shirt, you were supposed to run for this, for the restraint. On top of that, if you were any of those color shirts, you had to dish out the workouts. You had to dish out the work for the day. So it was a dog eat dog world, and we were forced to punish each other and keep an eye on each other. And the most messed up thing about that is most of us are all like still friends to this day. I say most because there are some girls we haven't been able to find. That's one of the things that messes with us to this day is the fact that we had to do these things. And if we didn't, and someone that just got punished and got knocked down to like a black shirt, if they wanted to get in Boyd's good graces, all they had to do was run up and say, oh, Amanda didn't give push-ups to so-and-so, and I heard her talking, and she shouldn't be talking because she's on a no-talking wristband. So we all were pitted against each other to continue these things. And that's one thing that it messes with me still to this day, but it does, it messes with all of us.
So, I mean, obviously that doesn't lead to any kind of, I assume that everyone was kind of just on their own. Were you able to build friendship at all? Any kind of camaraderie, or is it all just kind of, you know, fend for yourself and get by just to try not to, to aggravate, I guess, the leader, which was your father?
So that's the weird part, is we were able to build some sort of friendship. And I think that's because we all kind of just knew that we were all in a messed up situation. But at the same time, we did hate each other. But the moment we were out, we found each other on Facebook, and it was a little bit different once you're out. We were more friendly, if that makes sense. But when you're in it, like, I had friends that, I don't want to mention like names,
for sure,
as much, but I had two friends that, we did things together while we were there, but because they wanted to get back in my dad's good graces, they went and tattled on me as well. So like, it was like we were friends, and then you weren't friends, and then you kind of like just were like, okay, yeah, no, I get why you did that, and then you become friends again, if that makes sense. It's mm-hmm. it's really weird to think about, but yeah, some of us, like I said, we haven't been able to find everyone, but we're still really good friends to this day.
Yeah, and you've mentioned it several times, so we've kind of need to address for people. I'm assuming that's kind of a hierarchy, and whether when people are doing what they're supposed to be doing. What is all these shirt colors? Talk about that.
So agape is where my dad got the shirt colors, but he added on to it later on. And by the time I left, there were way more shirts than there was when I was there. So the ones I remember when I was there, orange was the lowest. That's when they first started. They did eventually add black before I left, and that became the lowest, which was sin. So orange was the lowest, and that was for new girls. So if you just got sent there, you automatically got an orange shirt. Yellow was you've been there for a couple of weeks, and you should know the rules, you aren't, you haven't been there long enough to be a pink shirt. Now, orange and yellow shirts had to have a buddy, which could have been a pink shirt or any higher up shirt as well. But pink shirts didn't have to have buddies. Pink shirts, you should have known the rule. You should know the rules. You've been there for a few months, and now you can basically be a buddy and teach someone else the rules. There were no incentives, basically, to getting higher up. You just got a little bit more. They say that you got a little bit more privileges, but really there were no privileges to be had. So there were no privileges to be had. But then from the pink shirt, it went to, I think, green, or it could have been purple, which meant you were junior staff, and then red, which was also junior staff, but you were like a leader, and so everyone was under you. I basically was a red shirt, so I was in charge of the kitchen, and then I had like the kitchen crew under me that I was in charge of, and then there were other girls that were like in charge of like feeding like the horses and stuff, and then other girls in charge of the dorms. If you were, like I said, if you were a purple shirt or above, you were junior staff, and you had to come for the restraints. Everyone below that did not have to do the restraints.
So you mentioned, you know, obviously there were horses there. There were other things, you know, you talked about woods. What did, you know, when parents would come, like what were they told that was happening? Was the place dressed up as, you know, a summer camp, a outdoor camp? Like, what made parents that came think, oh yeah, this is a great place to leave my kid? Were they able to kind of, you know, sweep off all the bad parts when people came, or what'd that look like?
So basically, parents were only there allowed on property for certain hours of the day. And if parents were there, we could not, it was no restraining. Push-ups were fine. Like, you could do things like that, but nothing extreme, which is, in my opinion, another thing that is very telling on the fact that they knew what they were doing. So they were very good at hiding it. Now, if anyone's watched Let Us Pray, the way the building looked all run down, and that's exactly what Circle of Hope looked like. So I have absolutely no idea why a parent was like, oh, this is great. I should send my child here, because it smelled disgusting. It looked like trailer trash, and I'm assuming the horses probably were really the only selling point, but even the property itself was like overgrown a lot with weeds and stuff like that. So I can't tell you why parents were like, oh, this is a great place, other than probably the price was cheaper than a lot of other schools.
So, you know, as I can see it going one of two ways, and they're both opposite extremes. And that's, given that your dad was the one who ran the place, you know, but let's look at it as a teacher. Sometimes, you know, when you have your parents as a teacher, it means that you get away with more. And sometimes that means they're extra hard on you. So what did that look like with you?
I will just say that when Circle of Hope was opened, it was the first time I ever felt anyone was able to see that I was being abused as a child, because I tried running away at Agape. I tried running away at the school in Florida, ran away multiple times in Virginia when they weren't even working at a school, because I was beaten severely. If you read what happened and a lot of the charges my parents got with Circle of Hope in 2020 when they were arrested, they were charged with stuffing socks in girls' mouths and duct taping their mouths, handcuffing girls, waterboarding girls. All of that stuff is how I was raised and how I was treated as a child. When Circle of Hope opened, it was not like that with the girls. They did not do those things until after I left. The way I see it is, the moment my parents' children turned 18, they were like, oh, we have no one else to torture this way. And so they started doing that to the girls. Like that, all of that, I believe it 100%. I'm not saying that I don't believe it, but all of that was a shock when I read that that was going on, because that was not how it was when I was there. Now that stuff happened to me. When they opened Circle of Hope, I felt it was the first time anyone ever actually saw like, oh, these kids are literally being abused, and it's not right. But they too were also being abused. So
did you, you know, obviously you realized this was not right, and it was not a great experience to be a part of, to put it lightly. But, you know, given you were raised that way, did you feel like it was normal, or did you always know that this was just a very bad, weird situation?
Well, that's the messed up part. I always felt like it was normal, if that makes sense. But at the same time, there was something in me that was like, there has to be something better out there. So ever since I was itty bitty, I knew I wanted to leave. Like, I did not want to stay in this. As soon as I was 18, I was gone. Like I said, I ran away multiple times and was brought back, and basically was told that how my parents are treating me is because of how I'm acting. And so it just solidified in me that this is normal. This is how other people are being treated. But it wasn't until I had my kids that I was like, I wouldn't do this to my own children. I can't believe this happened to me. And it took me having my own kids to sit there and go through therapy and realize, like, no, I was raised in a really, really abusive family, and it's continuing with other kids, and I needed to say something. I don't think if I didn't have my kids, I don't think I would have been able to come to terms with it the way I have come to terms with it.
Yeah. And I wrote these questions a long time ago. So I see that I wrote a question about how you escaped, and then also that you were kicked out. So which one is it? Does it rest somewhere in the middle?
I was kicked out. I like to say escape, because like I said, I was going to leave at age 18, no matter what. But if I the only way I knew I was going to get out was if I married someone. So I most likely would have just married within the IFB and wouldn't have actually ever gotten out of the IFB religion. My parents kicked me out at 17 because one of the main teachings within Independent Fundamental Baptist, I know people will say, oh, not my church or not how I feel, but it is one of the main teachings that women should not wear pants. And my dad gave a devotions one night talking about how if you were a woman and you wear pants, you're going to hell. And they had a 5-year-old girl, like I had mentioned at this time, and she was crying and she slept with me in my, like we shared a room. And I asked her, we were all in the big room. And so I asked her, I was like, why are you like, what's wrong? Why are you crying? And she basically was like, I don't want my mom to go to hell. Like my mom wears pants and I don't want my mom to go to hell. And I laughed at that time. And I said, honey, I was like, if your mom's going to hell for wearing pants, then my dad's mom is in hell because she died and she wore pants. And I'm pretty sure she was wearing pants the day she died. Same with my sister. They died the same day. Or no, not the same day. My dad's sister and my sister died the same day. And they both were wearing pants that day too. And so I basically told her that if that were the case, then my dad's mom, sister, and daughter are in hell that day. to that day. And that got back, like I said, how we all kind of snitched on each other to get higher up in the system. That got back to my parents. And at that point, my parents were like, you're going against our teachings. And so they kicked me out. I stayed for about a month because they didn't know where I was going to go. And so they eventually convinced my grandma to take me in. And so I went and lived with my grandma for a little bit.
So what was that a better experience? I feel like anything had to be better than what you were dealing with.
It was a way better experience, but unfortunately due to my trauma, I kind of fucked it up. Me and my grandma talk still to this day, but I eventually just was like, I can't stay here. My grandpa died. I miss my grandpa. And so I just left and have been on my own ever since.
Hmm. Yeah. And you kind of already answered it, but so if you were not to have been kicked out, you think that this would probably be not a conversation to be happening and you'd still be a part of it, or what do you think that would look like?
I don't think, actually, I can't say 100% sure, but like I said, I think I would have married into like a pastor or someone like that. And unfortunately, I don't think I would be here at this point in my life. I might have been on the edge of realizing at this point that I'm in a cult, but I don't think I would have been where I'm at now, able to speak out and say like, this is wrong, and continuing to speak on it.
So, you know, people who are listening can't see you. So I guess I just wonder, you know, you don't look like you are in IFB. That's for sure. You know, you've got tattoos, you've got some piercings, those type of things. So do you think that, you know, this is who you've always been and you were finally able to express it? Or do you think that you just were like, I'm going to do everything that is not IFB, just, and that's understandable too.
I actually think this is who I would have been if my parents weren't in IFB. And the reason I think that is because my dad had kids before I was born with another woman, and my sister ran away at 16. And when we were in, I was like 6, she came back and visited. She had tattoos. She drank. She listened to country music. And I was obsessed with her. And so I honestly think that I probably would have turned out like this if it weren't for the fact that, even if they didn't go into the TTI, I should say. So I think I am who I always wanted to be as a little girl. And that's my sister in a way.
Well, I'm glad that you were finally able to live that for sure. And I want to now get to, you know, how I reached out to you to begin with. And that's because of the documentary, Let Us Pray. How did you get involved in that documentary?
So weirdly enough, Sarah Smith, the lady that was in the documentary that wrote the article in 2018, I had spoken to her back then, but it wasn't until 2020 that I went to TikTok, and Sharon was working with the girls that were in that article. And I'm not sure if she because Sarah Smith and I were on Facebook at that time. So I'm not sure if she found it through Sarah Smith or if she just came across my TikTok. But Sharon came and found my email, hit me up and asked me if we would sit down and talk. And we did. And at that time, she wasn't sure how she would fit the troubled teen industry into her documentary, because it is two completely different worlds. It's the same, but it is really, really different. So she told me she'd get back to me. And I think it wasn't until 2022 or 2021, I think it was 2022, that she hit me back up. And she's like, hey, with talking to a lot of IFB girls, some of them were sent away to these schools. And I think that that's how we get the schools put into it, because it's extremely important, especially finding out that some of these IFB parents do send their children away to these schools. And so I told her that I would love to be a part of it. And there was a lot more to it. But with editing and stuff like that and getting like a lot of it did get cut out. But Sharon's amazing. And I honestly think that they did such a good job, even with the amount of stuff they cut out. I feel like they did a really good job explaining how these parents that are IFB do send their kids to these places and don't care. They don't care.
So was it at all kind of, it sounds like you kind of already were advocating at that point. And I think that you already involved in, you know, your parents, you know, being arrested, but was it hard to get on that documentary and share? Did it open up old wounds, or had you been dealing with those for so long? It was just a bill allowing you to share your story to a larger audience.
Well, I know I've shared some of my story on TikTok and I had been advocating, but a lot of what I had been advocating for wasn't about me. People would ask me questions, but I really didn't go into a lot of detail about my childhood until that documentary. And it did open a lot of old wounds. But at the same time, it healed a lot of the little girl in me, because I remember sitting in church thinking, I want to tell someone, like when I ran away and stuff like that, sitting there thinking like, I want someone to believe me. And then to be sitting there thinking I'm actually here because someone believes me was really healing. So it did open a lot of wounds and it did set me back a lot. But at the same time, I think I had to get set back mentally a lot to become stronger and able to continue speaking about this. So I do have a lot more wounds that I haven't touched, and I'm working on that. But I think it was really important for me to go a little bit more into detail about my childhood, because I realized that I was putting my own trauma down and helping other people rather than like focusing on my trauma. And I needed to see that in order to heal more. So.
No, well, I'm glad that opportunity was given to you then, for sure. A serious question to a very not serious question. And that is, you know, I noticed in the documentary, I don't know how they decided on, I guess, seating arrangements. They had some people sitting on the floor. You were sitting on a box the entire time. I think I've made you a little bit more comfortable in this interview. I think you're sitting on either a bed or a couch Indian style. So I'm glad I don't have you sitting on a box. I don't understand that.
I know a lot of people had issue with that, but I didn't. I honestly thought it was great because they wanted us to reclaim part of our trauma. And now I wasn't at Circle of Hope when the Get Right room was there. Well, I think they called it something else. That room came after my time, but at Agape, I was in the Padded Palace is what they called it multiple times, because at one point it was the nursery. And so I would watch the kids in there. And so it was a way of reclaiming that space. And so that's what that carpet, they did exactly the same exact color of the Padded Palace at Agape. And the part that got cut out was at the end, I ripped down the carpeting. And honestly, it wasn't like, I know people were like, oh, they look uncomfortable, but I wasn't uncomfortable. I usually sit on the ground anyways. It's way more comfortable for me, but they gave me a box and it worked perfectly because I had heels on and I felt really comfortable. But I did see a lot of people saying, oh, get them better chairs. And I was like, no, there was something symbolic about it. And I personally wish they kept that part in it. But like I said, they cut out a lot of stuff that would have made more sense to people if it wasn't cut out.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not the only one that noticed that. I thought it was weird they had you sitting on a box. So yeah, I thought that was kind of funny. But I guess I want to kind of now ask about back to a serious question, and that is you mentioned the documentary, something that I think that can really, you know, is really impactful for listeners who are dealing with the same type of thing, and that is traumatic things happening in your life that, you know, aren't really your fault, but you still kind of carry that guilt for something that really isn't something that you should feel that burden about. So talk a little bit about that, because I thought that was powerful.
Well, for me, I carry a lot of guilt with the being forced to abuse the girls. And I know people say it's not like I wasn't the one doing it or abusing them, but it that is something that does bother me. And it is really, really interesting that all of us in that documentary do carry trauma or guilt for trauma that isn't ours. That is something I'm still trying to work on. I can't say that I've undone my guilt. I've spoken to every person I can that I ever was forced to punish at Circle of Hope. Even to this day, like, I'll hit them up and be like, oh my God, I can't believe it. But they don't hold any grudges towards me. But for some reason, I hold a grudge towards myself. And I think that's because as an adult now, I would have said no. I would have gladly taken whatever they gave to me, punishment wise. But as a kid, you don't want that. You don't, all you think of is the pain. You don't think like, oh, this is wrong. They should be in the position that I'm in right now. That is something I'm still working on, is trying not to feel guilty for what my parents forced me to do. But, it's not easy not to feel guilty, to be honest.
No, I understand that. I think that the beginning part of that is just to understand exactly what you're saying, that, you know, you, that carrying the guilt that is undue. So I think that's half the battle that you've already realized. So I guess I wish you luck with you know, the rest of that journey for sure. I want to ask you now kind of where things stand with both the, you know, these ranches and then your parents. I believe they're both kind of have met their conclusions. So talk about that.
Unfortunately, my parents' trial got pushed back from November of last year to October of this year. So nothing has happened with that. We're still waiting on the trial. They did get off their ankle monitor, so they are just on house arrest, not GPS monitored or anything like that. And that's kind of frustrating. Agape, in my opinion, the people that mattered were not charged. Dr. Schmock, he is waiting his trial, and he does have charges between Agape and other states. But he personally, in my opinion, he does need to be held accountable and he does need to be charged. But he didn't start working at Agape until 2006. Brian Clemenson, who was there from the opening of Agape in the early 90s to the day of its closing, he was put on some, I don't know if it was like a child sex abuse law or just an abuse list, but he was put on a list. They didn't charge him, but he was put on a list for abusing kids at Agape and was able to go and plead in front of a judge to get off of that list. And he is off of that list. The five staff that they did charge were really, honestly, they need to be held accountable too, but most of them were students at one point turned staff, and they learned they weren't like me where they were born into it, but they learned a lot of what happened to them at Agape, and they should be held accountable. But in my honest opinion, the staff that trained them should be in jail or being held, being charged as well. But Brian Clemenson, like I said, got off the list. Jim Clemenson is dead, so he cannot be arrested or charged or anything like that. The Agape case is really infuriating because that town in Cedar County, they had two staff working at Agape. They were also deputies. And so a lot of it is, a lot of that is the reason why nothing happened with Agape, and it just kind of just went nowhere. Agape did shut down, but they opened up under a different name and are still allegedly and possibly abusing kids to this day on that property. It's kind of hard to find out any more information on them right now because they're smaller group homes. And when it was Agape, we had staff members that recently left because they didn't agree with the abuse that was telling us information. So like we had spies at one point, but we don't have that anymore. So unfortunately, nothing really, no justice has actually happened. We're still waiting on the Circle of Hope stuff. That town, Cedar County, is very corrupt. So I'm really hopeful my parents will get time. But at the same time, that judge has shown us multiple times that he doesn't care. He doesn't care about us. He cares more about the religious institutions than he cares about victims. And it's really, really hurtful. But we did get some laws changed in Missouri in 2021. And unfortunately, those laws are not being used properly, and this abuse is still happening in Missouri. I just went out this past week begging the Attorney General with SNAP, Survivor Network, Abused by Priest. We were out there, four different cities in Missouri, begging the Attorney General to do something, to use his power to fix this, because another school was shut down. One of the staffers from Agape that was charged ended up working there and abusing more kids. That school was just shut down. And there was another school where two kids just recently ran away. And we found out since 2020, 17 kids have run away from that property. So Missouri is still a safe haven for these religious institutions to abuse kids. And unfortunately, even Circle of Hope and Agape haven't really done much to scare these places from continuing. And we have a lot of work to do in Missouri, but I'm not giving up. We're going to continue to speak out until Missouri does something about it.
No, that's awesome. And I think I know the answer to this, or we wouldn't be talking, but what's your relationship now with your parents?
I don't have a relationship with my parents. Unfortunately, I think that they think I did this out of hate or out of spite, when in reality, one thing that weirdly religion kind of teaches is you discipline out of love. And I don't think I could have been able to do anything nearly successful like I have with this if it weren't for the fact that I am doing this out of love for my parents as well, because this could have ended it ended really badly, but this could have ended way worse. Someone could have been killed, it could have been bad, and it would have continued until my parents died. And in my opinion, I think it was best, it was best for it to end. But I felt at that time like if I didn't do something, it would have continued with my parents, and there would have been no time for them to actually sit back and be like, holy crap, I did something wrong. Now, will that ever happen? No. But everything in me, that's what I wanted. That will never happen. But like I said, like I didn't do this because I hated my parents or because I wanted them to feel that I hated them. It was actually quite the opposite. And that's the only thing that I wish they could see, but they wouldn't. So
three final questions to wrap things up, and that's to bring us to present time. I want you to talk a little bit about the work that you're doing, the advocacy work you're doing. You just talked about going to the Attorney General. What kind of things are you doing to try to help make sure this doesn't happen to other people?
We just launched a organization on Monday. Well, we haven't like launched the website yet, but we have started an organization, still coming up with a name. Our organization is going to be a lot like SNAP, where it's not just in Missouri. We're going to have, like I said, there are thousands of these places throughout the United States. And so we're going to have an organization in each state, represented by a survivor of whatever school they went to there. And so we're going to take this state by state because, like most of us know, you can't get a law put into place to affect religious institutions like this federally. You have to go state by state. And so that is our goal. Now, it's not just for religious institutions. You could have been to any TTI program, and we will help you any way we can. But we are forming this specifically state by state because we do need the backing behind us to show, like, these are all these survivors went through this, and we need something to protect people that are being held in a religious institution because you should not be allowed to use your religion to abuse kids. And so right now that is in the working process of getting started, but that is what we're doing right now. We are focusing on starting an organization and building an army basically to go state by state and hopefully federally for the non-religious programs, but we have to do it state by state for the religious programs.
No, that's awesome to hear for sure. And I want to now just ask, we know what you're doing when it comes to this work, but what does life look like outside of all this for Amanda in 2024?
I honestly am a mom. And so I, life outside of this is being a mom that I never had and healing myself by being a mom. Me and my kids have a relationship that I would have never had with my parents. And that is honestly my goal. Even if I wasn't doing all of this stuff with the TTI and all of that, I think I would have been okay with just being a mom because, that's something I realized that I missed out on, and I don't want my kids to miss out on that. And it does help a lot being able to sit there and have a conversation with my kid about something that he went through at school. Whereas like, I was going through something at school, I would have never felt good enough to be able to tell my parents. But for my son to be able to come home and just tell me like, hey, mom, today didn't go that well, it makes me happy because, like I said, I never had that.
No, that's awesome for sure. And truly wrapping things up, this is where you kind of shout out any connection points. I don't know whether you're kind of active right now, but shout out those connection points, anything you want. You said that you don't necessarily have a name for your organization yet, but anything you want to shout out, please do.
Yes, we don't have an organization name yet, but if you follow me on TikTok, which is Not My Father's Daughter, and like the number 3 at the end, or my Instagram, which is Berlin Von Mortis, I will be posting that as soon as we get it. We'll have a website with resources and all of that on there as well. Yeah, those are the two. I don't have a Facebook. I mean, there is a Facebook, but I don't go on my Facebook. So those are the two places really.
No. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
So that was Amanda Householder. Really, really, really appreciate her time today. You know, like I said in the beginning, when I have people on that are sharing very traumatic experiences, I don't take that for granted. I don't think that that's an easy thing. So I really appreciate Amanda being here. I learned a lot this week. That's the theme of every week. But I knew a little bit about the troubled teen industry through listening to other podcasts, both with Amanda and with other people from other homes, both in and outside of IFB. I've listened, to the documentary and Amanda speaking about this, but I didn't know quite the depth of it. So Amanda taking her time to share that, I hope that you learned a lot. you know, this story is not resolved. You know, we talk about how her parents still have not went to trial. So keep your eye out for updates there. You know, I looked at it just a couple weeks ago when I spoke to Amanda, and you know, there's still active news articles about it for sure. Follow along with Amanda. I'm sure she will keep you updated with that too. She's got a really great TikTok and Instagram that shares a little bit more of her story that we didn't talk about. So yeah, urge you to follow along with her. Urge you to stay up to date on this story. So, you know, frankly, this type of thing doesn't happen again. You know, they, you know, I'm glad that, you know, her parents and others involved are facing some repercussions, but like Amanda said, it doesn't sound like everyone is, and those who are not necessarily getting, you know, as much punishment as maybe they should have when, you know, the name of their game were to punish people in a very unfair way, and you know, their punishment would be maybe unfair in the opposite direction here. Yeah, thank you, Amanda, for being here. If this is your first time listening, please go follow along on Facebook, jacksonhuff.com, Not Enough Podcast on Instagram. Go follow and subscribe on Apple or Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a 5-star rating. That helps a lot. Leave a written review on Apple. That helps even more. But if you do nothing else, catch us next week. Lots and lots of great guests upcoming. Lots of great guests in the past, over 190 episodes, several episodes in the past with people from various cults, if that is something that you enjoy listening to. But everything else from Olympic gold medalists to famous nostalgic actors and actresses to some people doing some really awesome jobs. So go check those out, but catch us next week. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think, or hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.